Welcome to the debate. You know, if you take a stick and draw a line in the dirt, it's really just a line.
Right, it's nothing.
Exactly. The wind will blow it away, the rain will wash it out. But if you take a pen and you draw that exact same line on a piece of paper and call it a national border, suddenly the dirt on the left is fundamentally different from the dirt on the right.
It's completely transformed. I mean, and it's not just the dirt that changes, right? It's the entire moral reality of the people standing on it.
Mm-hmm.
The person standing on the left of that invisible line, they're a citizen. They have rights. They have access to courts. They are structurally protected. But the person stepping just an inch to the right of that line?
They're a foreigner.
Exactly. Suddenly they're a foreigner, a migrant, or, you know, a threat.
It's a massive, world-altering cognitive leap. Yet we all just kind of wake up every day and accept it as the absolute default background of our lives.
Yep. It's just the way things are.
Right. But today, we are taking a hard look at that phenomenon. We're diving into the framework presented in the treatise, The Sovereign Enclosure of Life.
Such a fascinating text.
It really is. We are looking at the modern nation-state not just as a given, but as a highly specific, historically constructed technology. And the central disagreement we are exploring today is, this is the nation-state fundamentally a life-harm machine that sacrifices living ecosystems and marginalized people to maintain its own sovereign power?
Or, on the flip side, is it an indispensable, reformable container for protecting the civil commons?
Right. And for those listening, when we say civil commons, we're talking about the shared resources that keep us alive and thriving, right?
Yeah. Public health, sanitation, education, shared legal rights, the basics.
Precisely. So I'll be representing the perspective that the nation state, while definitely scarred by a deeply flawed history, is still the essential and reformable apparatus for coordinating those large-scale public goods. It's what protects vulnerable people from private domination.
And I will be taking the opposing perspective, namely that the Westphalian nation state, which is really just the academic term for our modern system where every country has unquestioned authority over its own specific territory, is structurally pathological.
Structurally pathological.
Yeah. It relies on what the text calls sovereign enclosure, meaning it inevitably prioritizes its own administrative survival over actual human and ecological life.
So let's jump right in. Because, I mean, to build a serious critique of the state, I think we first have to acknowledge its immense capacity to protect life.
Okay, sure.
Yes, the state is an ambivalent tool. I can see that. But it is the exact specific mechanism necessary to build those civil commons we just mentioned. Think about how we coordinate a nationwide sanitation system.
Right.
Or, you know, standardized medical licensing, or mobilize a massive disaster response to a hurricane. The state has this unique, scaled capacity to pool resources through taxation and enforce a monopoly on legitimate force so that rules actually matter.
But at what cost, right?
Well, if we romanticize statelessness as some sort of utopian liberation, I think we are making a grave mistake. Statelessness exposes the most vulnerable people to warlordism, to unchecked corporate domination, to unregulated extractive markets.
I see what you're saying, but
the state needs a deep moral reorientation, yes, but it does not need structural dismantling.
I look at it from an entirely different angle. The nation state isn't just some neutral administrative wrench that we can simply choose to turn in a better direction.
What is it then?
It is an epistemic and moral container. And what I mean by that is, it actively shapes how we perceive reality. It artificially compresses the vast, living plurality of human beings into a rigid, standardized, you know, imagined community.
Okay, but
let me just finish this thought. The treatise uses the phrase sovereign enclosure of life. Practically, this means the state takes territory, law, and violence, and fuses them together into a sacred idol.
A sacred idol? That's a heavy term.
It is. And when that idol is forced to choose between actually healing a harm and maintaining its own unquestioned authority, it will routinely sacrifice living bodies and ecosystems. It is structurally designed to manage and hide the harm it causes rather than actually heal it.
Let's unpack that structural design, though. because a major premise of the text is that this underlying architecture was forged in war and colonial extraction.
Absolutely.
So we really have to address the origins of state capacity before we judge its current utility.
We do, because you cannot neatly separate what the state does today from how it was originally built. We have to look at the mechanics of history.
Right, bringing in Charles Tilly's one.
Exactly. If we draw on Tilly's theory, which the source material heavily relies on, the state was born directly from war-making and protection rackets.
War-making makes the state, and the state makes war.
Spot on. If you were a European ruler in the 17th century and you wanted to wage a massive war, you had to extract immense resources. You couldn't just guess what was out there. You had to meticulously tax grain, map the land, count the exact number of able-bodied men to conscript them.
So you were saying the administrative tools themselves were born from violence?
Yes. The very same administrative systems that you praise for running our modern hospital systems today, they were originally built to extract resources and rip bodies out of communities to feed a battlefield.
Mm.
And when we look outside of Europe, we see colonial rule perfecting this. The text points to the Caribbean plantation as a proto-state.
Right, as a laboratory.
A laboratory for organizing land, forced labor, and surveillance into a hyper-efficient export machine. That is the foundational DNA of the modern state. You can't just slap a public health label on an apparatus built for extraction and expect it to behave perfectly.
Okay, let me pause you there, because while that history is undeniably accurate, the utility of those tools has evolved. Let's talk about how the state, how it sees.
Seeing like a state.
Right, the political scientist James C. Scott. I will fully concede that the state oversimplifies reality. It uses censuses, rigid property grids, standardized names, all to make a very messy society legible to bureaucrats.
Highly legible, yeah.
But that simplification is exactly what makes equity possible. Let me give you a concrete comparison. If you go into an emergency room, the triage doctor uses a set of specific medical codes that vastly simplifies your complex, unique life story.
Okay, but...
Hold on. It is a massive abstraction, yes. But that administrative simplification is exactly what allows the hospital to allocate blood, oxygen, and surgeons to save your life.
Right.
The census and the property map are the state's triage tools. Without them, how do you distribute vaccines? How do you plan a power grid?
Wait, hold on. I have to push back on that emergency room analogy because it completely falls apart at the level of intent and power.
How so?
An ER doctor simplifies the patient's data to heal the patient. The early states simplify the population to make it governable, taxable, and available for the draft. The triage code doesn't permanently replace your identity.
True.
But the state's administrative categories, they often permanently replace living reality.
Give me an example of the category replacing the reality then.
Let's talk about land. I mean, if you're listening to this, think about the deed to your house. You view that piece of paper as your ultimate protection.
Most people do, yeah.
But historically, a community might have had a complex, intergenerational, sustainable relationship with a local forest and watershed. Then the state comes in, throws a rigid grid over that living ecosystem, and issues formal property titles.
To make it legible.
To make it liquid. It turns a living relationship into an ownable, liquid parcel of property. Let's call it Parcel A. Suddenly, Parcel A can be bought by a distant investor who has never set foot there and who legally clear-cuts the forest.
Okay, I see the harm there.
The state's legibility didn't save that community. It enclosed it, blinded itself to the ecology, and made it legally available for destruction.
But without that formal property title, that exact same community has absolutely zero legal defense against that corporate entity just rolling in with bulldozers anyway.
I disagree.
The state's legal framework, as rigid as it is the shield. And going back to the census, yes, the state creates demographic categories, but those categories are what allow us to identify systemic inequalities.
Sometimes.
Most of the time. How do we know if a minority group is being financially redlined if we don't have demographic data from a standardized census? How do we hold powerful institutions accountable without standard measures?
Well, you hold them accountable by actually listening to the wounded communities, not by relying solely on the rigid metrics of the very institution causing the wound.
It has to be both, though.
But this brings us to the most dangerous consequence of these administrative categories. They don't just organize the people inside the state. They create a hard, unforgiving line against the people outside of it.
Ah, moving back to the border.
Exactly. The text refers to this as bordered moral perception.
Meaning the border changes how we value human life?
Precisely. The border acts as an ethical anesthesia. It dictates whose suffering we are allowed to care about. Inside the border, a person is a citizen, a patient, someone fully deserving of those civil commons you keep mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
But cross that invisible line, and a human being is administratively downgraded. They become a migrant, a burden, an illegal.
That is a stark way to put it, but yes.
And this structured perception is what allows the state to use legalized violence. It allows a government to authorize a drone strike and call it child's death collateral damage. Or watch people drown in the sea and call it migration management. It completely numbs us to the humanity of anyone outside the container.
I hear you. And, you know, the tragedy of statelessness and the global migrant crisis, it is an undeniable, profound moral failing. I am absolutely not defending cruelty here.
I know you're not.
But we do have to acknowledge that near care is a fundamental reality of human psychology and social organization.
What do you mean by near care?
Think of it this way. A house has walls and a locked door. The family inside doesn't lock the door because they hate the rest of humanity, right?
Sure.
They lock it because they have a localized, intensive obligation to protect and provide for their own children first. Nested responsibility requires a stable center. Can we not have special obligations to our citizens without completely erasing the humanity of the foreigner?
That sounds perfectly reasonable until you look at reality. A house with a locked door doesn't actively bomb the neighborhood, extract all the water from the neighbors' yards, and then shoot the people who come knocking for help because their own homes were destroyed.
Okay, that's...
That is the fatal flaw in the house analogy. The nation-state doesn't just quietly protect its own in a vacuum, it externalizes its costs, and the people arriving at the border are very often fleeing conditions created by the very states locking them out.
Through historical colonialism. Or unequal trade.
Exactly. Or climate change. The border isn't just a protective door. It's a moral filter that justifies structured, systematic non-rescue.
We certainly need a vastly more humane migration framework. I agree with that. And we have transnational obligations. But practically speaking, dissolving the legal distinction between citizen and non-citizen doesn't automatically create a utopia of global harmony.
I'm not saying it creates a utopia.
But it does create a massive vacuum of responsibility. If no specific institution has a border-defined mandate to care for a specific population, the provision of the civil commons completely collapses. You need a legally defined jurisdiction to levy the taxes to build the hospital in the first place.
But your jurisdiction is completely arbitrary when it comes to the actual physical mechanics of life on this planet.
How so?
Let's transition from the border's failure to contain human suffering to its total failure to contain the natural world.
Okay, the ecological argument.
Right. This is what the source material calls the ecological contradiction of sovereignty. Life operates through highly interdependent systems, you know, watersheds, ocean currents, the global carbon cycle.
Right.
But the state governs through completely rigid jurisdictional lines that completely ignore biology. It reduces living, breathing ecosystems to national resources or development assets.
Well, to be fair, the state also creates national parks, enforces the Clean Water Act, and funds environmental protection agencies.
Inside its own borders? But a carbon molecule doesn't stop at passport control.
That's true.
The atmosphere is not Westphalian. Look at small island states, especially in the Caribbean or the Pacific. A small island state can flawlessly govern its beaches, protect its local reefs, manage its fisheries.
But they're still sinking.
Exactly. Its coastlines are literally being swallowed by the rising oceans, caused by the sovereign emissions of distant great powers. The island is told it is a sovereign state, perfectly equal under the UN Charter. But its actual physical conditions of life are being annihilated by the industrial policies of other states.
So sovereignty is a fiction there.
It is a fiction that allows great powers to treat the global atmosphere as a free dumping ground while hiding behind the legal shield of domestic jurisdiction.
Look, the scale of climate change absolutely exposes the limits of traditional sovereignty. I grant you that entirely. But I have to ask, what is the alternative mechanism for accountability?
Well,
you cannot sue a cloud of carbon. Dissolving state sovereignty doesn't clean the reef.
Small island states actually rely heavily on their formal UN sovereignty to fight back.
Do they, though?
They do. They use their status as recognized states to demand loss and damage financing and to force large emitters to the negotiating table on the global stage. Isn't that sovereign seat at the table literally their best weapon? If you take away their statehood, they don't gain ecological harmony. They lose their only legal mechanism to fight back.
I understand why it looks that way, but let's look at how that mechanism actually functions. That seat at the table is what political theorists call an organized hypocrisy.
Organized hypocrisy?
Yeah. Sovereign equality in international law masks massive material inequality in reality. Yes, the small island state gets one vote at the UN. But it does not have the geopolitical leverage, the military, or the economic weight of the great powers.
Sure, the power dynamics are skewed.
By forcing the island state to play the game of Westphalian sovereignty, we trap it in a system where its literal survival is subject to the voluntary, unenforceable pledges of the exact nations that are actively drowning it. Sovereignty without the material capacity to protect your life grounds is just a brittle dignity. The state form here isn't curing the ecological decline, it's just politely managing it at international conferences.
But again, you have to negotiate with the entity that actually has the administrative capacity to regulate the factories producing the carbon. That entity is the nation state. We need intense, binding, transnational cooperation, not the abolition of the state itself.
But the state, as currently constructed, suffers from what the text calls institutional denial. It will always prioritize its own economic procedures over actual life correction.
Give me an example.
We see this all the time in what's called developmental sacrifice. A state will willingly displace a local community, bulldoze a vital wetland, poison a local watershed, all to build a megaport or an open pit mine.
To boost GDP.
To pay off external national debt and to boost GDP, yeah. And it calls this destruction development. It sacrifices the actual life capacity of its people to boost an abstract metric. The state is operating exactly as it was originally designed to, extracting from the periphery to feed the center.
I would argue that is a profound critique of the metrics of development, not the political container of the state itself.
I don't see how you can separate the two.
Well, I completely agree with you that measuring a society's success by GDP alone dangerously obscures the depletion of actual life. But let's move to the cures proposed in the source material because we have diagnosed the symptoms thoroughly here.
Fair enough.
If the state is so pathological, what exactly are you proposing we do?
The text pushes for a radical restructuring.
It does. It argues for a shift toward conditional sovereignty and bioregional nesting.
Okay, let's pause here. When you use a heavy phrase like bioregional nesting, what exactly are we talking about in plain English? How does that actually work?
It means that political authority needs to scale to the living system rather than an arbitrary map line. Instead of a straight line drawn through a desert, governance should scale to the watershed, the food shed, or the regional sea.
Okay, so geographical boundaries based on nature.
Right. Think about the Colorado River in the United States. Right now, it's managed by several different rigid state governments, all fighting over water quotas based on lines drawn a century ago, while the river itself literally dries up.
Yeah, it's a massive crisis. Bioregional nesting would mean the ultimate authority over that water belongs to a council representing the entire ecological watershed, superseding state lines. And the second part, conditional sovereignty, means that sovereignty is no longer an absolute shield.
Meaning you can lose it.
Exactly. If a government destroys its life grounds, if it poisons its own water or starves its people, it legally loses its moral legitimacy and its right to govern. We have to dethrone the border as the ultimate authority.
Look, I support modifying state behavior heavily, but I advocate from what the text calls civil commons constitutionalism.
Right. Reform over replacement.
Exactly. We don't need to overthrow the state. We need to reprogram it. We need to embed the protection of water, food, healthcare, and ecological integrity directly into our existing constitutional frameworks. We absolutely need better metrics. Measuring ecological depletion on the national balance sheet instead of just economic growth.
But is that enough?
I think we can achieve ecological stewardship without abandoning the stability of the nation state. Bioregional nesting sounds beautiful in a textbook, but practically speaking, How do you enforce a watershed-level regulation across millions of people without a state apparatus to tax, monitor, and police violations? The territorial state provides the necessary scaffolding.
But the scaffolding is currently strangling the building. If you just bolt new environmental constitutional rights onto an apparatus that was fundamentally designed to extract and conquer, the apparatus will eventually co-opt those rights.
I don't believe it's that deterministic.
It's like trying to run advanced conservation software on an operating system built for logging. You can't just tweak the metrics. You have to change the entire orientation of the institutions. They must become responsive to the wounded.
Responsive how?
When a community says, this new copper mine is destroying our home, the state's response cannot be, but the environmental impact assessment procedurally cleared it. The actual, physical wound has to be allowed to update the legal model.
And I am telling you that a democratic nation state is quite literally the only political form we have ever invented that has the internal mechanisms, courts, elections, a free press, to allow that wound to update the model.
In theory.
In practice, too. When the state ignores the community, it is failing its own democratic promise, yes. But the promise itself is sound. We don't need to destroy the political form. We need to transform it into a servant of life rather than its master. We need to actually fix the damage together.
But the democratic promise is always severely bounded by time and the nation.
How so?
The state will always prioritize its current citizens, and usually only the elite ones, over the internal minorities, the migrants, and crucially, future generations. Future generations have no vote. They are the ultimate excluded political community.
That is a fair point.
A nation state operates on 2 to 4 year election cycles and immediate debt horizons. It severely discounts the future. It creates a time border. So how does your civil commons constitutionalism account for the fact that politicians are legally and structurally incentivized to consume the future to pay for the present?
By explicitly writing intergenerational rights into the Constitution, which, by the way, several forward-thinking nations are already beginning to do.
It's a start.
By establishing independent public trusteeships for ecological assets that are immune to election cycles, it is entirely possible to legally mandate long-term accounting within a state structure. The state can be a steward if we demand it.
It can only be a steward if we finally strip away the Westphalian myth that the state is the ultimate unquestionable authority on Earth. We have to recognize that the living, breathing world is prior to the sovereign container.
Well, let's summarize where we've landed in light of this exchange, because despite our deep disagreements on structure, we are actually converging on a few critical realities about how broken the current system is.
I'll start. My stance is that the nation state, operating under this myth of Westphalian supremacy, is an idol that demands sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
It compresses living plurality into a rigid identity. It turns the border into a moral filter that legalizes violence against outsiders, and it abstracts living nature into exploitable inventory. Until we dethrone the border and replace sovereign impunity with accountable, life-coherent governance based on actual ecosystems, the state will merely manage our ecological and moral decline rather than cure it.
And my stance remains that while we must fully acknowledge and reckon with the deep historical wounds of colonial borders and extractive economies, the state is still the only vehicle robust enough to protect the civil commons.
Even with its flaws.
Especially with its flaws, because it is the only entity with the sheer capacity to push back against private domination and global corporate capital. The goal is not to destroy political form. It is to transform the state from an idol into a servant. We must constitutionalize the civil commons and force ecological accountability into the state's core mandate.
We definitely converge on the fact that our current metrics of success are disastrous. Judging a nation's health by GDP or military spending, while its aquifers literally run dry and its communities fracture, is a profound institutional delusion.
Absolutely. And I think we also firmly agree that statelessness is not the cure.
No, definitely not.
A vacuum of public authority does not lead to a bioregional utopia. It leads to predation. The solution lies in building better, vastly more accountable institutions, not the absence of them.
True. The ultimate challenge is making those institutions genuinely accountable to life itself, rather than just legally accountable to their own administrative survival.
As we wrap up, we want to invite you, the listener, to look around your own community today. Look at your local watersheds, your local schools, your hospitals, and your borders.
Think about the institutions that govern you.
Exactly. You have to decide for yourself if the political containers you live inside are serving life, or if they're demanding its sacrifice.
There is so much more to explore in this material, especially regarding the on-the-ground mechanics of how we might actually heal these historical wounds in a participatory way.
Indeed. So the next time you look at a map, ask yourself what living realities were cut and what human responsibilities were hidden just to draw that line.